Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. Today, we are going to be exploring a pretty fascinating section of Mark's Gospel, chapter 6, verses 7 through 44. And we're really fortunate to have this lecture by Dr. Mark Jennings to help guide us as we kind of unpack some of this, a really fascinating section that deals with the mission of the 12 disciples, the dramatic execution of John the Baptist, and of course, the iconic feeding of the 5,000. So a lot to cover, and I'm really excited to dive in.
Yeah, this is a section just jam-packed with symbolism and deeper meaning that, you know, we often kind of just read over quickly, but there's so much more there.
So let's just jump right in with those 12 disciples, right? They sent out in pairs by Jesus, which right away I was like, okay, there's got to be something more to this than just like a buddy system, right?
You're picking up on something important there.
Yeah.
The fact that they're sent out in pairs, Dr. Jennings points out that this actually links back to the Old Testament idea of needing two witnesses for anything to be considered valid.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. So it gives their actions and teachings a sense of authority and credibility.
Interesting.
It's like a built-in system of accountability, too. They're keeping an eye on each other.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. But what about those, like, super specific instructions they're given? I mean, only a staff. No bread, no bag, no money sandals, but no extra tunic. Like, it seems a little harsh.
Well, yeah, it might seem that way on the surface, but that's precisely the point. Dr. Jennings emphasizes how this is all about highlighting their dependence on God. They're stripped of any material possessions, any status symbols, anything that could distract them from their mission.
Wow, yeah. When you put it that way, it's like a total paradigm shift. It's rejecting the kind of worldly focus on wealth and security.
Exactly. And that theme of radical dependence is emphasized even further by Jesus's instructions on hospitality.
Oh, how so?
The disciples are to accept whatever hospitality is offered to them. They're to stay with whoever welcomes them. No shopping around for better accommodations.
So it's like a lesson in humility and gratitude, accepting what's given freely and focusing on that connection rather than like the comforts.
Yeah, you got it. But what's really fascinating is how this theme of dependence plays out when the disciples encounter rejection.
Oh, wait, when they get to a town and people are like, yeah, no thanks, we don't want you here.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Jennings points out the instruction to shake the dust off their feet if a town refuses to welcome them.
Yeah, that always seemed a little dramatic to me. Like, is it just a way of expressing frustration or?
It's actually more than just frustration. It's a symbolic act of judgment and separation.
Oh, okay.
It's essentially saying we're disassociating ourselves from this place. And, you know, this mirrors the experiences of acceptance and rejection that Jesus himself faced throughout his ministry.
So it's like a foreshadowing of the conflicts to come. And speaking of conflict, we can't ignore the dramatic turn the story takes with the account of John the Baptist's death. It's like this dark interlude dropped right in the middle of the disciples' mission.
Right. It's kind of jarring, isn't it? And Dr. Jennings actually refers to this as a Markan sandwich.
A Markan sandwich?
Yeah. Basically, it's this flashback episode that doesn't directly involve Jesus.
Okay. So why is it stuck in there?
Well, it's not just randomly placed. This literary technique is really crucial for understanding the story's deeper meaning.
Okay, so help me understand that. Why is this placed right here?
Well, think about what immediately precedes this episode. The disciples have just been sent out to mimic Jesus' own ministry, but they are also told to embrace simplicity, rely on God, and be prepared for rejection.
Right, and then boom, we hear about John the Baptist, this prophet who challenged authority and paid the ultimate price for speaking truth.
Exactly. And we're presented with this stark contrast, the decadence and corruption of Herod's banquet, versus the simple righteousness of John the Baptist, who, like Jesus, challenged the status quo and ultimately faced death.
It's a bit chilling, honestly. Like, it seems like Mark is giving us this warning that following Jesus isn't going to be a walk in the park.
Yeah, it's definitely a sobering reminder. And that warning is further emphasized by Herod's conflicted reaction to John. He was, you know, greatly puzzled, yet liked to listen to him.
Oh, he was, like, intrigued. But
yeah, he recognized John's righteousness, but ultimately chose political expediency over doing what he knew was right.
That's a very human struggle, isn't it? Recognizing the truth, but still being swayed by fear or self-interest. And it makes me wonder, is this also kind of foreshadowing how some will react to Jesus's message?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think Dr. Jennings would agree with you. There's definitely a parallel being drawn here between Herod's reaction to John and the mixed responses Jesus will receive. Some will be amazed, others will be skeptical, and some, like Herod, will be caught in the middle, unable or unwilling to fully embrace the truth.
So it really sets the stage for what's to come. But before we dive into that, let's maybe take a closer look at the disciples' return and the events that lead up to the feeding of the 5,000.
All right, let's explore that next.
So the disciples, they come back from this whirlwind mission trip, you know, probably exhausted, needing a break. But the crowds are relentless, aren't they?
Yeah, it seems like they just can't get a moment's peace.
Yeah.
People are so eager for Jesus' teaching and healing.
Yeah.
I mean, they practically chase the disciples down.
And that's where we get that really powerful image. The crowds are described as sheep without a shepherd. And that's not just a random description, is it?
No, not at all. Yeah. Both the Old Testament and Jewish thought at the time frequently used the shepherd as a metaphor for leadership guidance, and even God himself.
So when Mark describes the crowds as sheep without a shepherd, it's highlighting their desperate need for true leadership, right? For someone to guide them in the midst of all this chaos and uncertainty.
Exactly. And it's implicitly contrasting Jesus with the other leaders of the day, like Herod.
Yeah, that contrast is pretty stark. I mean, on one hand, you have Herod indulging in this feast that ultimately leads to death and violence. And then on the other hand, you have Jesus moved by compassion for this hungry crowd.
It's a powerful juxtaposition. And the disciples, seeing this vast crowd and their obvious hunger, they actually interrupt Jesus' teaching.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, they're concerned. It's late. They're nowhere nearby to buy food for all these people.
So practical, right? They're like, send them away, let them figure it out.
Right, exactly. But Jesus has something else in mind entirely.
Oh, I bet. What does he say?
He challenges them with this really unexpected command. He says, you give them something to eat.
Whoa, I imagine the disciples were completely taken aback by that.
Oh, absolutely. They
yeah.
point out the sheer impossibility of it all. I mean, they don't have the resources to feed a crowd this size. It would have been an astronomical expense.
Yeah, no kidding. So what happens?
Well, Jesus persists. He tells them to see what they have, and they come back with this really meager offering, 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish.
5 loaves and 2 fish? I mean, hardly enough for a small picnic, let alone a multitude.
Right. And this is where it gets really interesting. Dr. Jennings points out that Jesus instructs the people to sit down on the green grass.
Okay, green grass. Why is that detail important?
Well, it might be an intentional echo of Psalm 23. Mm. You know, he makes me lie down in green pastures.
Ah, okay. So it's strengthening that image of Jesus as the good shepherd caring for his flock.
Precisely. And then he takes those 5 loaves and 2 fish, blesses them, and begins to distribute them.
And somehow, miraculously, it's enough to feed the entire crowd with leftovers to spare. I mean, the sheer abundance of this miracle is astounding.
It really is. And there's this one detail that Dr. Jennings highlights, something that often gets overlooked.
Yeah.
The text doesn't actually mention the crowd's reaction to this incredible event.
Oh, that's interesting. So they don't, like, gasp or cheer or anything. It's just silence.
Yeah, it's just silence. So do you think it means they didn't grasp the significance of what just happened?
Maybe. They were just happy to have full stomachs, not seeing the deeper meaning.
It's certainly possible. Mm. They might have been focused on the physical satisfaction, you know, the immediate relief from their hunger. But perhaps, as Dr. Jennings suggests, this silence is also a way of highlighting the disciples' unique perspective.
Ah, okay. So they're the ones who truly witness the miracle, who see the impossible become possible right before their eyes.
Exactly. Maybe this is another step in their journey of understanding who Jesus truly is.
Wow, that's a great point. And this miracle, it's just the beginning. Dr. Jennings points out that the feeding of the 5,000 actually kicks off a recurring pattern, a cycle of events in Mark's gospel. A cycle. Tell me more about that.
Well, following this feeding miracle, there's a trip across the lake and then a healing miracle.
Okay.
And this pattern repeats later in Mark, the feeding of the 4,000, another journey across the lake and another healing.
So Mark is intentionally structuring his gospel around these recurring cycles. But what's the purpose? What's he trying to emphasize?
That's a question that has intrigued scholars for centuries. But Dr. Jennings suggests these cycles might be a way of highlighting the importance of both physical and spiritual nourishment.
Oh, I can see that. The feeding miracles address physical hunger, while the healings point to a deeper spiritual need. But what about the trips across the lake? Where do those fit in?
Well, now that's where it gets really interesting. Remember, in biblical imagery, the sea often represents chaos, danger, even the forces of evil.
So when Jesus calms the storm or walks on water, he's demonstrating his power over those forces, right? His authority over all the chaotic elements of life.
Exactly. And those powerful demonstrations often lead to moments of teaching and revelation.
Mm.
The disciples witness these incredible displays of divine authority. And then Jesus uses those moments to deepen their understanding and prepare them for what lies ahead.
Okay, so these cycles aren't just random events. They're these carefully crafted narratives that highlight these key themes of Mark's gospel. Jesus' power over chaos and evil, the need for both physical and spiritual nourishment, and this ongoing process of discipleship.
Precisely. And those cycles also help to emphasize the contrast between Jesus and other leaders. Remember, Herod's banquet is marked by self-indulgence and violence, while Jesus' banquet, the feeding of the 5,000, is a miracle of abundance and generosity.
It's a feast that takes place in the simple setting, echoing that imagery of Psalm 23, and it points to something greater, something beyond just physical satisfaction.
You're getting it. It points to that ultimate banquet, the messianic feast that awaits God's people and the kingdom to come. It's a powerful symbol of hope and transformation.
This is incredible. I'm starting to see how all these seemingly disparate pieces fit together to create this much larger, more profound picture. But we've covered a lot of ground already. Maybe we should take a moment to kind of reflect and then explore those deeper implications of these cycles and the ultimate question Dr. Jennings poses about the significance of the feeding of the 5,000 in light of Jesus's ultimate fate. Okay, I'm still processing all these connections. Dr. Jennings is making these recurring cycles, the contrasting banquets. It's like a whole new way of seeing this familiar story. But there's one question that really stuck with me, and it's kind of a head scratcher. What is the significance of the feeding of the 5,000 in light of Jesus's ultimate fate?
All right. It's a question that challenges us to look beyond the surface,
beyond
the immediate act of compassion and provision, to see that deeper symbolic meaning.
Especially because the Gospel of Mark is so focused on Jesus's suffering and sacrifice. It's almost like there's this shadow hanging over the entire narrative. So how does this miracle of abundance foreshadow the cross? How are those two things connected?
Well, Dr. Jennings doesn't give us a simple answer, but he does offer some intriguing clues. He points out that the feeding of the 5,000 takes place in a remote place, a word that could also be translated as wilderness.
And that wilderness setting immediately makes me think of the Israelites wandering in the desert, completely reliant on God's provision for their survival.
That's the connection Dr. Jennings is hinting at. He's prompting us to consider the parallel between Jesus providing for the hungry crowd and God providing manna for the Israelites in the wilderness.
Is it possible that this miracle is also foreshadowing the Eucharist? The bread of the wilderness becomes the bread of life, the body of Christ broken and given for the salvation of the world.
That's a really powerful insight. The feeding of the 5,000 isn't just about physical hunger. It points to a deeper spiritual nourishment, a sacrifice that will ultimately sustain us.
And the timing of this miracle is significant, too. It comes right after the account of John the Baptist's death. John, the voice crying out in the wilderness, is silenced. But then Jesus, the true shepherd, steps in to provide for his flock. It's almost like a passing of the torch.
A passing of the torch that leads towards an even greater sacrifice. Remember, John's death foreshadows Jesus' own fate. Both are rejected. Both face opposition and violence. But even in the face of that darkness, Jesus continues to demonstrate compassion and provide for those who follow him.
It's like Mark is showing us that even though suffering and death seem to have the upper hand, ultimately love and sacrifice will prevail.
Exactly. And that triumph is rooted in self-giving love and a willingness to lay down one's life for others. The feeding of the 5,000, with its echoes of the Eucharist and the wilderness wanderings, ultimately points to the cross, the ultimate act of self-sacrifice.
This entire deep dive has been a revelation. I'm seeing these stories in a whole new light.
And that's the beauty of Scripture. It's a text that keeps unfolding, revealing new layers of meaning as we grapple with its complexities.
And as we grapple with those complexities, maybe we can gain a deeper understanding of our own journeys of faith. So for all of you listening, here's a final thought to consider. The Gospel of Mark is framed by these two bookend miracles, the feeding of the 5,000 and the Last Supper. How does that framing shape our understanding of Jesus's mission and message?
It's a question that invites us to dive even deeper into the mystery and meaning of the gospel. And on that note, we'll leave you to continue your own exploration. Until next time.